Thank you very much, Paul. Paul is one of the people who comes every day, every semester. He's my last speaker in my piece of work class and adds all the pizzazz that gets those students out on the streets following the class. So really, the activist spirit has a lot to do with Paul Shannon, wherever I go, as most of the people in this room know. When I walked in here, somebody I know said, I understand you're going to give your new vision of the world tonight. And I said, I didn't know I'd been tapped for that purpose tonight. Exactly. And then a couple other people said, we're just talking about, I've been hearing now several times about how people on the left want to talk about positive things, how to make things different and stop focusing on problems. How are we going to solve them? Now, again, if I could give you the, you know, a real new visionary approach in that area, I would do it. I'd throw whatever I've thought about and do it, because I agree these are central issues. But I don't think I can do justice to it myself, although I'm happy to, you know, if we have any extra time to maybe some of the conversation here will move us in that direction. And in my view, the fact that this march, which is, I know they're aiming to get 1 million people into marching from, what, Columbus Avenue down to Times Square on the 21st. I'm going to be there. Columbus, yeah. Up to, so it's not a very long walk. You don't have to be able to trek Mount Everest to go to do this march. Anyway, that's a sign of hope. For me, hope has a lot to do with action. And that's why I'm here, just to try to do whatever we can to bring together people who still have enough hope to get out and walk and to move and to make these ideas something more than just words. So Paul and the people who are doing this are interested in talking tonight about the relations between the different movements that, and I know a lot of people in this room, and I know a lot of people here are in the peace movement, a lot of you are in the climate movement, a lot of you are related to the labor movement, the immigrant rights movement, but I think the focus that Paul asked me to sort of hone in on tonight was war and climate change. So I just want to say a little about it. I think that I'm not sure I can add a lot more to, because I know, again, I know a lot of people here. I know a lot of you have thought a lot about these issues. And I hope I'm actually interested in having a little bit of time to chat. So I'll just say a few things. First of all, war and climate change are both existential issues, right? They're the two great existential issues, by which I mean they raise questions about the future of human existence as we understand it, right? And as Paul said very well, these two great existential issues are deeply intertwined. Wars are fought for oil, and the Pentagon is the largest single institutional emitter of fossil fuels in the world. And larger agenda of militarism has to do, I think, with conquering markets and arenas for cheap labor and other needs of capitalist production, which requires a global environment that is friendly to Western corporate interests. So in all these ways, we know that war is contributing to the growth of a militarized capitalism, and that militarized capitalism is a recipe for climate change. And I think most of the people in this room understand enough of this that that I don't want to go too much deeper than that and maybe leave a further conversation about that for later. I want to say a little bit more about two things. One, at the end, about the implication, because since I've been writing about Piketty, Piketty's on my mind. How many of you remember Piketty, out of curiosity? Remember this book that came out called Piketty? Yeah, okay, so he's still alive. How many of you have read him, by the way, just out of curiosity? A few, okay. All right. So there's something in that book that is useful in talking about capitalism. There are only 3 pages on climate change in that book, and on nothing, almost nothing on militarism, which is one of the problems of the book. But I will bring him in a little bit toward the end. I want to say just a little bit more about the relation of climate to militarism. In other words, how it is that climate change is contributing to war and to militarism. Now, let me just say, one can be too facile about this issue, right? War, there are a lot of people, including people in the Pentagon, who are now saying, the Pentagon now lists climate change as a principal driver of war. Now, one has to be careful about this, right? Because in discussing climate change as a driver of war, it's easy then to forget about capitalism and other major forces that drive war. So I don't want to jump on the bandwagon which says that we should primarily look at war as a function of the changing climate. So I think that, in fact, there's a danger that the current ideological, there's sort of new ideological forces at work in the power centers, which argue that that's how we should be thinking about it. And it's a way of diverting attention to some of the more fundamental causes of U.S. Militarism and interventionism. However, I will give the Pentagon does say in multiple reports, they describe climate change as what they call a threat multiplier. Right, you've probably seen this language. And this strikes me as somewhat more reasonable. I mean, war has multiple causes, and I see climate change as a contributor to some of the conditions that precipitate war. And by war, I want to talk mainly about American intervention, because America is so central to the war system that operates in the world. So let me just say first, in wanting to say a little bit about how climate change drives militarism, I don't want to overstate that. I'm not trying to say, I think you need a kind of political economy of capitalism to understand why war takes place. And you can talk about, I also think you need that kind of political economy to understand why climate change is taking place. So in some sense, both war and climate change are arising out of a similar well of structural forces, and that sort of speaks to what Paul said at the beginning. These are integrated movements that are rooted in the way our economic system and our political system are operating. But just to hone in a little bit further on thinking about the relation between climate change and war, I think the common way, and the way I've learned, and probably most of you have learned to think about this, is that climate change is contributing to new kinds of resource scarcity. This is kind of a theory that Michael Clare, who I think is coming, Paul, right, in a couple of weeks, and has written a number of books.
The 11th.
The 11th, okay. That should be very interesting. And he's written a lot about war as a function of resource scarcity. I mean, he wrote Blood and Oil, but he talks about wars more generally as functioning out of resource scarcity. And climate change is certainly producing scarcity. Of what? Well, land, right? Because land is being submerged. Of land in which food can be produced, because there are droughts, and a lot of areas of land that used to be under cultivation can no longer be cultivated. So that you get kind of, I think the common view, and I think there's a good deal of truth to it, that if climate change is, quote, a threat multiplier, one of the reasons is that any conditions that might give rise, that we typically think about, to military intervention by Western companies, Western states, and so forth, may be intensified or accelerated by changes in the environment. So, and now I think the more conventional view of this would be sort of one of the traditional notions that population explosion or other kinds of scarcity simply produce competition for land, space. It is true that 60% people love to live on water. So of the world's population, 60% live within 60 miles of a coast, right? And how much of that coast is going to be underwater in 50 years from now or less? Well, I guess the military cares about this because Norfolk, Virginia, which is right on the coast, is going underwater, and there's a big naval base in Norfolk, Virginia. So, some of the military is encountering some of this. But it does mean that people are going to be displaced. When a lot of people are displaced, that can accelerate conditions that lead to war. So I want to just talk about, to be concrete, because I think most of you are sort of familiar with this analysis, a few wars that I think exemplify the force multiplier idea and the threat multiplier idea. One, Rwanda. A lot of people believe that Rwanda is, to a large degree, the first major climate genocide. How many of you have heard that, have thought about a connection between climate change and the conflict in Rwanda? No? That's interesting. I would have thought more. Okay, so the basic argument is that the radical Hutus in Rwanda were able to gain traction. I mean, I think, again, this is the kind of thing, in a political analysis, there were a lot of other reasons why there might have been a genocide of the Tutsis, which was a minority population, but a ruling population in Rwanda. But it turns out that Rwanda is one of the most densely populated and one of the areas of the world most where temperature rises have contributed to the greatest amount of drought and to difficulty in growing crops. So one way of thinking about this is that the genocide took place because large numbers of people were not able to get food and water. And what do you do when you can't get food and water? Well, if you can identify a group of people in a country that can somehow be marginalized or eliminated, then you might have a solution to the problem. So I think it is reasonable, from what I know about the Rwanda conflict, to argue that it is the first major climate genocide. By that, I don't mean, even if there had not been a climate crisis, and even if there had not been drought and extremely hot temperature, there might well have been, in fact, there was, going back, conflict going on between the various warring units in Rwanda. So it might have happened anyway. But I think it's reasonable to argue that Rwanda happened with the force and the power that it did because of the incredible density of people on very small amount of land, which was not producing enough crops for people to live. This is sort of a Malthusian model of how a climate conflict can happen. Another example that I'm sure might be coming to your mind as I'm talking about Rwanda is Darfur, right? Because in Darfur, in southern Sudan, southwest Sudan, there's been a major change going on in climate. It's getting hotter, and pastoral groups and hunting groups in that area were beginning to be pushed into each other as a lot of land didn't get cultivated. And again, I think because you can go back a long, long time and see conflicts between the north and the Arabs in the north of Sudan and the Africans in the south of Sudan. So again, I wouldn't pin climate change as the only source of the horrible, horrible violence that's been going on in Darfur. But it's a contributor. And I think it's a contributor for the obvious reasons that people were fighting over increasingly scarce water and land. Now, I want to mention just two other places that I've just been reading about a little bit more recently. One is Syria, and one is Iraq. How many of you have read anything about the role of climate change in contributing to the conflicts? Some of you, okay. So let me just tell you what I know, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, because these are obviously wars. I mean, it seems to me that Obama is moving us very deep into a new I mean, you don't go into air wars without forces on the ground, so we now know that Obama has put over 1,000 forces onto the ground in Iraq and in Syria, because you can't use air power effectively without guidance from the ground. So how does climate change relate to Syria? I think this has been studied a little bit more. There's been a heating and drying process going on in the Mediterranean and the Middle East, probably since about 2006, 2007. It got quite intense in 2011. And what that has done in Syria, particularly toward the north, where there's already a lot of conflict with the central government in Syria, is that about 85% of the farmers were pushed off their land because they couldn't support themselves in the land, on the land. And they were driven into cities in Syria. Now, at this point, at about the time that the Arab Spring was taking place, the American intelligence analysts were arguing that Syria would never get engulfed in a conflict like this because it was seen as one of the most stable countries in the Middle East. And that was probably an erroneous assumption from the beginning, but they certainly at that point had not taken into effect the rather dramatic effects of pushing so many people off of their land, which has started to happen, I think, in 2008 and then went on for a number of years. Now, what happened was that the Syrian government, which never had particularly good or fond relations with people in the north, basically did not help. So a lot of people were driven into the cities and were then basically left hungry. And there was drought and lack of food. And so as things began to get worse for other reasons, people living in the cities outside of Damascus up north were more, I think, more angry, more desperate, more ready to see some dramatic change. So I think this contributed to the sudden growth of instability in an area that the American intelligence was telling, you know, the government was going to be pretty stable. Obviously, America had no trouble with Assad. They like dictators in the Middle East, and they liked them as long as they were promoting stability. But the breakdown of stability in Syria probably had quite a bit to do with climate change, because you just had so many people rapidly displaced and lacking the ability to feed their families. So that's interesting. And it's interesting in thinking about what a renewed bombing attack in Syria, as America starts striking inside Syria against ISIS, how that is going to play out. Now, I just want to mention one other closely related area, which is northwest Iraq. So in the area that ISIS has taken over in Iraq, that area has been hit by the same pattern of weather change that has taken place in Syria. And so it's not quite as pronounced, and I haven't seen as much written about this, but basically a similar pattern has taken place. These are Sunni farmers in the area of northwest Iraq, obviously, in any case, alienated from the Baghdad government, from the Maliki government, now the Adabi government. And unquestionably in my mind, given what's happened with the American occupation of Iraq and the essentially turning of the Iraq army into a Shiite militia, which had no interest in integrating the Sunni population, even without climate change, there would be the potential for a very serious... I mean, it's. I think you might have gotten something like what's going on in Iraq happening anyway. But when you consider the effect of large numbers of Sunni farmers already dispossessed politically, having no place in the Maliki government, having no army that was speaking to their security needs, suddenly in situations of extreme insecurity, it seems to me more understandable that the Sunni population, most of whom would never, I mean, Iraq was not traditionally, as you all know, sympathetic to Al-Qaeda, was, Saddam was a very secular leader, secular kind of socialist kind of in the Arab world view. It's not a place that would have lent itself to this kind of religious ideology and so forth. Now, did climate change contribute to a kind of desperation among people who had felt abandoned anyway by their government and were now having an alternative of a militia which was promising them resources to reclaim some sort of way to live a life for their families? Probably, I can't speak authoritatively about this, but my guess would be that this has played a role. And it may be quite significant because, I think Obama's view has been, well, you do another version of the surge and the awakening, and you put a lot more money into this to the Sunni tribes people in this region, and then they'll fight ISIS and they will go back and join some sort of more bipartisan or unified government. Well, it's going to take a lot more resources, given the legacy of the war already there, the long occupation, the long devastation, and this new information that I've been getting about the condition of the climate in this whole area, which makes me think there's no way that with this new government, this post-Maliki government in Iraq, that you're likely to see a Shiite government, which has basically marginalized the Sunni populations, turn over the amount of resources, let alone share the security forces, in a way that would lead to the kind of thing Obama is talking about. It just seems extremely difficult to imagine that scenario playing out. And then there are other parts of Africa, Latin America, and so forth, where you could make, I think, similar kinds of argument. And what's interesting about this is that I think that, even though people in this room are some perhaps a little bit familiar with this, the climate movement and the anti-war movement are pretty separate. They don't tend to share a common analysis. Have you guys at 350 ever heard this kind of analysis in your meetings at 350?
We don't tend to go into it. No.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think if you went to most discussions of peace issues, you wouldn't hear a lot of discussion about the role of climate in these conflicts. So it's a really good example of what Paul was talking about, which is that we're operating with problems that are flowing out of common, structural crises, aggravated by all kinds of other factors, and we're thinking in silos. And therefore, we're thinking too narrowly about very difficult and large, integrated, organic, systemic problems. And I think that's why we're here tonight. And that's why, I think this march coming up is so important, because it basically, as I understand it, Leslie Kagan, a lot of the peace activists who have been behind this climate march are basically saying we are the climate movement. We are not just ACT peace people, we are climate people. And I'm hoping the labor movement will, because if we had time for a full analysis of war, we'd certainly go into an analysis of capitalism and globalization, and we would get the labor movement in here talking about things that they don't tend to talk about. Although, again, we've seen, to express a little bit of hope, I think this kind of thinking is growing. The ultimate problem is not so much, it seems to me, that it's going to be impossible to get these movements to communicate with each other. It's that the movements themselves are so weak. Now, in the case of the climate movement, there are a lot of people who care about this issue, but not a lot who are willing to get up and act with the urgency that the issue deserves, right? So that's another issue. But certainly, to get major change on these huge issues, you don't need all the population. In the 60s, when I became an activist, I would say probably less than 20% of people my age at the time, college students, were activists. But, you know, the civil rights movement and the anti-war Vietnam movement had a major effect. So I think you don't have to think about the only way we can get change is by convincing the entire population. That's the way. What you need is a very committed minority of people who understand the connections between these different issues. And I don't think that's a hopeless task at all. But it does, I think it does push against the boundaries of the way people who are both thinkers and activists are organizing their lives and their thinking. They tend to feel, look, there's only so much time in the day to do things. I'm going to focus on this one issue, and I'm going to go through. So I think our movements do have some common work to do. And, of course, the biggest work, I don't think, is so much transcending these silos, which is hard to do, but doable, it seems to me. But expanding that base till we get to a critical minority where we can really make structural change on these larger issues. So I'm going to be, I'm going to shut up, be unprofessorial, and end my remarks. And Paul, I don't know what the timing is. I know we want to spend a lot of time tonight in talking about the logistics of the rally coming up. But thank you for your attention, and look forward to any, if we have time for conversation, for a thing.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
And I didn't get to Picardy, but I'll get to Picardy.